to another Yes Life show. My name's Robin Daly, and just over 10 years ago, I set up the charity Yes to Life to support people with cancer in the UK in taking an integrative approach to their treatment, one that allies conventional treatment techniques with the broadest possible range of complementary and natural approaches. In this show, I'm talking to two people about a cancer treatment I've known about for more than a decade, which single-handedly makes the case that medicine, in particular cancer treatment, is driven neither by economics, science, nor clinical effectiveness. Photodynamic therapy, or PDT for short. I started off with a visit to UCH to meet a world-leading expert in PDT, Colin Hopper. He's been at the forefront of developments at the National Medical Laser Centre at UCH for two decades.
Colin, it's great to have you on the show today, and I'm very interested to hear more about PDT, which I've known about for some years and frustrates me like mad that it's not more generally known about.
Yes, it's been around as a technique for over 100 years. The first descriptions were back in Germany about the turn of the last century, where lip cancers were successfully treated using a dye and light. So maybe we should start off with the principles of
what
PDT
really is.
So photodynamic therapy involves the administration of a drug that makes you light sensitive. Now, the drug can be administered topically, it can be rubbed onto the skin in the treatment of skin cancers, or it can be given intravenously or by mouth. So there are different ways of routes of administration. But the drug gets distributed through the body and gets retained by the cancer tissue. Cancer is not very good at metabolizing some of these drugs, so when the drug level has fallen in the normal tissue, it remains high in the cancer. And then this drug is activated by applying light. So obviously if you're treating a skin cancer, you apply light from the surface and the light penetrates through and kills the cancer on the surface. If it's a deeper tumour, like in the lung or in the mouth, at the base of tongue, sites that are harder to get at, then we can deliver light down laser fibres that can be placed directly into the tumour. So there are a number of different drugs, and they all have their different profiles. Some leave you quite sensitive to sunlight for quite a while. Some of the very early drugs, it can be anything up to 3 months, so you have to avoid sunshine. I'm not talking about artificial light. That's
right. Direct sunshine.
But direct sunshine, there's an awful lot of light in direct sunshine. So some of them have quite long periods of what we call photosensitivity. Others have relatively short periods of photosensitivity.
Mm-hmm. That's a kind of developmental thing, isn't it? It's basically the newer ones tend to be better in this respect.
Well, we've got some very good drugs that have licenses. So we're all the time trying to find drugs, as you say, that are improvements on that. And the three improvements we want to work on. One is the interval between giving the drug and doing the treatment, mm-hmm. which ideally should be very short.
Right.
Some of the best drugs have a drug light interval of 4 days, for example. It's manageable, but it's sometimes a little inconvenient.
Yes.
We're looking for a greater depth of effect so that more tumour can be killed. And we're also looking for the minimum amount of photosensitivity so that people can go back to their normal lives and normal outdoor activities as soon as possible.
Hmm. Okay, so maybe you could just walk us through a typical patient who's getting treated.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you need to have two examples, one who's got skin cancer, one who hasn't. It's obviously a bit different, but what they go through and what they experience and what does they experience following treatment as well.
So let's start with the very simple treatment. Let's start with a topical treatment of a skin cancer, a rodent ulcer, that sort of condition. So for even very widespread, as long as they're not too thick, these cancers can be effectively treated by applying a cream, leaving that under a dressing for a matter of several hours. Patient can have normal activities while that's going on, and then after 4 or 5 hours, light is delivered, usually by an array of light emitting diodes. And the red light is shone at the target, and it's shone there for quite some time. Patient just sits there and has the treatment. No need for local anaesthetic or anything like that. And after the treatment, they go home. The treated area may blister a little, it may be a little uncomfortable, but not really painful. And then the tumour undergoes cell death, it undergoes necrosis, and the whole thing drops off. And with
from
that,
one treatment.
Yeah, well, it's usually one treatment, although if you have a particularly difficult area, you can go back and retreat. So that's certainly possible. And that kind of treatment is available in over 100 units around this country.
Okay.
So that is fairly straightforward.
And what would be the whole time scale of that from start to finish? Do you think
start to finish, you'd do it in an afternoon.
No, but I mean the whole process of actually feeling like, okay, I've got my arm back again, it looks good.
Oh, it'll look good after about 10 to 14 days, it'll
wow.
start looking good. It's a fairly superficial effect, and that's its limitation.
Hmm.
Now, we have much more powerful drugs that we use, particularly for things like mouth cancer, where the drug is given into a vein, it's given intravenously, and then it's activated after 4 days.
Mm.
Now, with the more powerful drugs, you can kill tissue down to, well, anything up to about a centimetre. So that's a good depth of tumour necrosis. So if you have an early, let's say you have an early mouth cancer, you can get rid of all of that. There are a couple of very interesting advantages of PDT over conventional treatment. And it's all to do with the way that the wound heals.
Right.
So first of all, nerves in the area are spared. They don't take up the drug in the same way that other tissue does. So that if you treat close to the, let's say, the facial nerve, the one that supplies the muscles of the face, or close to the nerve that supplies the side of the tongue, you can treat this without damaging the nerve. Now,
retain full use of
yeah. So, yeah. So there's this great functional
advantage,
and we've shown this in cell culture experiments, in animal experiments, and by observation in human patients. We've treated close to all of these nerves and functions preserved. And the other thing is the way the PDT treated area heals. There's no real selectivity between cancer and non-cancer. That's something we're trying to work towards. But it's the ability of PDT damaged tissue to make a good recovery and heal with little or no scarring that is one of the great advantages. And of course, if one's comparing it with surgery where tumours are cut out, then there is a loss of tissue which is avoided with the PDT.
Some of the after effects of having surgery around your face or throat are pretty damaging, aren't they?
Well, yes, it does. It very much depends on the size of the tumour that you're trying to treat and the
right.
exact location. But you can damage, you can get functional and aesthetic compromise. So if you cut tumours out, then you may end up with a big scar, you might end up with a big dent. And if you're anywhere, say, at the back of the tongue, you may impair tongue function, and that will interfere with speech and swallowing and all the rest of it.
So except in some exceptional circumstances, if you're going to choose between the two, it would be a bit of a no-brainer, wouldn't it?
Well, I think we have to be just a little bit careful
mm-hmm.
Because conventional treatments in so many conditions are very good. So that, for example, if you have a cancer at the base of the tongue, I think it's well known that Michael Douglas had one of those that was all over the mm-hmm. press. If you have cancer in that location, a combination of chemotherapy and radiotherapy will give you a very high cure rate,
mm-hmm.
certainly up into the high 80s, probably even a bit higher. So to advise someone to have a treatment that's not quite fully worked out when the conventional treatment has such good outcomes is always a bit tricky. So you have
yeah.
to balance that, and I think we need to move on in slow steps. So taking that same example, if you're in the unfortunate 10% who don't get cured, then that situation is very difficult. And then if you're comparing salvage surgery, which may mean removing most of the tongue, which then has effects on swallowing, so some people might even suggest that you take out the voice box, the larynx, at the same time to prevent getting recurrent pneumonia. If you're comparing that kind of salvage surgery to PDT, where the results are certainly no worse with PDT. The numbers aren't huge, but we're fairly confident that the outcome is about equal, then that's a no-brainer. Because
so when you say the outcome, the lifespan is what we are talking about.
Yes, so we're talking about survival and length of survival. So I'm afraid that even with heroic surgery, 5-year survival figures are not great. Our figures that we looked at, we've got something over 30% at 3.5 years, which certainly compares pretty favourably with salvage surgery after all these other treatments. So there are clear opportunities here, and that is in fact what the most commonly used drug in this country is licensed for. It's licensed for the treatment of advanced or recurrent treatments where other options aren't available.
Right. Okay, so yes, I wanted to ask a bit about the types of cancer that it's applicable to. Firstly, the ones that there is good evidence for and it's well supported, and then others that by extrapolation or through your own clinical experience, it's certainly worth looking at.
So most of the stuff in head and neck terms, is, with skin, it's mainly basal cell cancers, but in the mouth, most of the published work is on oral squamous cell carcinoma, which is the common type of mouth cancer. It's particularly common among people who tend to smoke and drink. That's not the only cause, but that's one of the causes. If we're looking at those groups, we know that for early cancer, the outcome with PDT is the same as with surgery, but without cutting any tissue. And for more advanced disease, when all else has failed and we're running out of options, then in selected cases where you can get light to the whole volume of the tumour, you can get anything up to a 50% complete response rate. And this is a really tough to treat group of individuals, and that's all been published with a confirmatory study that came out a couple of years ago.
Right.
Now, if we're turning to what might be a useful target, then there are lots of things where it may be useful. So in the cancer field, just about any cancer theoretically will respond to this, because no cancer cells are immune to the products of this interaction between the drug and the light. Malignant melanoma can be black, and there can be problems with the light being absorbed, so that may not be a smart target, but things like some of the rarer salivary gland cancers, even cancers that have started elsewhere in the body, where you can get a very good prolongation of quality of life with PDT. You might not cure someone, but it'd be very useful.
So you're like treating lung secondaries or something like that?
So I saw a gentleman yesterday who had got a mesothelioma, which is a lung tumour that metastasised his tongue. And that's the sort of thing one might consider PDT for treatment. And then there are a whole host of other things. So all of our focus has been on cancer, but really there are lots of other conditions. So, for example, patients who have congenital malformations of the lymphatic tissue, so-called lymphangiomas. These tend to have quite a good blood supply, and if left, they cause facial deformity and secondary growth deformities. And in fact, it's considered such a serious birth defect in France that it is a legal indication for termination of pregnancy if it's found on ultrasound scan on an in utero. So that condition is absolutely brilliant. So it's there are various types, but there's one where there are lots of little cysts, and they're very thin. Very thin lymphatic walls, and if you put a fibre into the middle of this, the light bounces off the walls and it takes out the lining of all of this abnormal tissue. If you try and do that surgically, you'd have to cut so far beyond to get all these little bits out, but because the light bounces around. Oh yes, and they all relax. They all come back. So for some of the larger, what are called macrocystic lymphangiomas, then surgery still has a very well established place. But you can do that operation without causing too much damage to normal tissues.
Okay, so maybe just go a little bit scientific for a minute and just talk a little bit more about actually what's going on, how it works, for some people like to hear a bit of the science behind it. So the agents, what are they exactly, and why does the light affect them, and what happens when the light does affect them?
Okay, so the first drugs that were used were all blood-derived products, so they were extracts of hemoglobin. The various names, but Photofrin is one that is commonly used, particularly in North America. In Europe, particularly in the UK, there have been other drugs developed, and the most powerful one that we use commonly here is a drug called Foscan, and that's a synthetic chlorine. It's they're all ring structures, and their biochemistry is very variable, but they have the ability, when activated by light, to generate what are called free radicals and very active oxygen species. And these active oxygen species cause damage to the DNA, to the cell membrane, to all sorts of things that lead to direct cell killing, loss of the blood supply, damage to the small blood vessels, especially the immature ones that you tend to get in cancers. And there's certain there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that it triggers this process of apoptosis, which is programmed cell suicide. So there are multiple different ways these drugs work.
So the newer class of drugs, then, rather than being from blood, they're more synthetic. With chlorophyll, is that right? They're more related to plants, in fact. Yeah?
Some of them are. And some of them are related to organisms that live in the dark on the bed of the ocean.
Really,
the French have been looking into all sorts of things. So that's all rather fun. Yeah. But there are lots of new developments, and the target now is to try and reduce the drug light interval and reduce the period of photosensitivity.
Right.
So I don't want to overplay the light sensitivity. So what we tend to find is that we give the patient a drug at day naught, we treat at day four. By the time we do the treatment itself, any artificial light is perfectly safe.
Right.
Patient might need to be careful for a couple of days, and it's really only the sunlight. So you have controlled re-exposure to light after two weeks or so. You gradually go back into the light, and that photo bleaches the drug in the skin, and you get back to normal.
Hmm.
So
it's an inconvenience.
But to be fair, patients with advanced head and neck cancer don't go out much.
Right.
So as one could imagine, and it is important not to let them sit in a darkened room, because they get very fed up. Mm. When we first started doing some of these studies, we possibly were overcautious, as we all would be under those circumstances. But we kept people in the dark too long, and they got fed up. And what's more, when they did go out into the sunshine, if they did leave it a bit longer and thought they were okay, they'd still get burnt because they hadn't been photobleaching the drug in the skin.
Mm.
So controlled re-exposure to light is the watchword.
Yeah. So the power of this combination is that, the first of all, you have a drug that actually tends to collect in cancerous tissue anyway, and then you can target it carefully with the laser light.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be exactly the right kind of light, I understand.
It has to be the right wavelength. So depending on which drug you use, so some of them are activated by, most of them are activated by red light, but some have activation wavelengths in the green or the blue.
Mm.
Depends, you can use the wavelength of light to control the depth of effect.
Mm.
So sometimes you want the maximum depth of effect, and then you're usually talking about slightly longer wavelength of light, around 6.652 nanometers or more. But sometimes you don't want that deep an effect. You don't want a very deep effect, for example, in the esophagus, in the gullet, because you might make a hole all the way through, and that's bad.
Yeah.
So it is possible to choose the right drug, the right light, to get the right effect.
Mm. So you've been through an awful lot to get to that piece of knowledge. Of course, that's a very sophisticated piece of knowledge.
Yes, it's been a difficult journey over 20 years.
Yeah, right.
It really has.
So maybe you could tell us a bit now about the progress of PDT elsewhere in the world. I mean, are there other countries that are fully embracing PDT as a mainstream cancer treatment, for example?
So this is one of the great sadnesses I have, that currently PDT in this country is not funded by NHS England. I'm not sure of the reasons, because in fact it's a relatively small number of patients who would require this complicated sort of treatment, relatively small number. But globally, it's really taken off, so that in Japan, China, Russia, they do quite a lot of it. There's in Seoul, we had an international conference there recently, they're doing quite a lot there. But probably the biggest growth area is South America, because Brazil have rolled out a big skin cancer treatment program, which they're incorporating with lots of other centres in South America. I've been involved in setting up a PDT treatment centre in Bolivia, where there are no arguments about comparative treatments, which is the best, because a lot of patients do not have access to what we would consider appropriate treatments. So globally, 100 million people don't have any radiotherapy, for example.
Right.
So this is a very cost-effective treatment for developing countries.
I was going to say, this is the thing about it, particularly with skin cancers, it must be very cheap, basically, isn't it?
Well, the Brazilian manufacturers of the equipment have a bit of kit that's quite small. It'll fit into a small suitcase. It's got two arms on it, so the idea is you rub the cream onto the cancer. One of the interesting things about this cream is if you shine blue light, you will actually map the cancer and it'll glow pink.
I've heard about this, right. Yeah.
And that's fantastic. So in one piece of kit, you've got a piece of kit that'll help you map the tumour, and then you switch hand pieces and you've got a red light that will treat the tumour.
So it's even a diagnostic tool.
Diagnostic. So I think they call it theranostics is the okay
fantastic
word.
Fantastic.
And the other great development globally is coming back full circle to the States, who fell in love with PDT, then fell out of love with it, and now there's something in the middle, and they now have a national database of all the treatments they've done, looking at lung and upper aerodigestive tract, and that is a fully funded database that allows information to be gathered, and hopefully we'll be able to join our information with that to improve our knowledge base.
Well, you here are in a very different situation, where basically they're not even getting the funding you were getting for what you're
doing.
That's
right. Yeah.
Extraordinary, really, that such a progressive, cutting-edge treatment that clearly has so much potential is just not getting funded. For you personally, after all your 20 years, that must be pretty gutting to be in that position. But maybe even more so because of your awareness of how much this could actually be doing for people out there with cancer. Many conditions that it's ideally suited for, and many conditions that people are getting treated in a comparatively barbaric way and suffering major after effects from. This is one of the things that Macmillan's highlighted recently, where they said, OK, we've got more people surviving, but what's their life like?
And what cost is the big question.
Yeah.
And that's particularly true with head and neck cancer, because even with the most sophisticated surgical techniques, and they are very sophisticated, removing large lumps of tissue from the mouth and the face and doing tissue transfers to fill the hole, all these sort of things, they are very clever. The operations usually take all day and sometimes a little longer. And the techniques have improved. The problem is, if you're starting to move tissue from one part of the body to another, what you're not moving is functional, innovative tissue. So you can make things look really smart, but when you actually load any function into that, it's a bit disappointing. But I don't want you to think that I feel that I've wasted the last 20 years of my life, because
you definitely haven't.
I have. We have rolled this out into projects in India. A very good friend of mine in Indonesia, he works at the National Cancer Institute in Amsterdam, but his family comes from Indonesia. He goes out there and treats patients out there. And we've got this project in Bolivia. We're trying to set things up in Ecuador and various places. So I have, I've almost come to the stage where I will try and get things back on the books in England, I'm getting quite enough job satisfaction of things around the world.
The interesting thing is that the indicators are here that the places where it's best received are the places that want an economic treatment that works, which clearly says Britain doesn't want an economic treatment that works at some fundamental level, otherwise they'd have snapped it up. I mean, we've got an NHS crisis of funding, and they're not looking at this a potentially huge saving in cost of cancer treatment.
So we showed, it was quite a few years ago now, that this is a cost-effective as well as an effective treatment. It is very much cheaper than a course of radiotherapy or palliative chemotherapy or palliative surgeries. One can debulk a tumour and you can put a reconstruction on and you can improve people's quality of life, but we can do at least as well for less cost.
Less money and probably a lot less discomfort.
And that's in a European setting. Mm. You've got to bear in mind that in a European setting, our lasers will cost us somewhere around £50,000, give or take a bit. The drug costs will be about £8,000 per treatment, per patient. If we transpose that to Brazil, the light sources they use will come in a box for $3,000. Mm-hmm. And I've just got a 4-channel laser made to take with me to Bolivia that's of the order of $10,000. Dollars, not even real pounds.
When you think of £5,000 a month is a pretty average cancer drug bill for a patient. Yeah.
Yes. So some of the drugs we have access to are pretty good drugs, but they aren't made in Europe. They're made in Russia rather than conventionally, and the drug cost per patient is of the order of $200 or $300 per patient. Mm. So that brings the whole cost. It's a capital cost for a laser, so you have a capital outlay, but that laser should last you several years.
Yes.
You'll need some fibers to deliver the light, but you can get miles of this cable for not very much. It's very cheap stuff, and then you've just got the consumable of the drug.
Mm. We're involved with a lot of people who are kind of dissatisfied with the way things are and they want to see change, and this is in the public I'm talking about, and it seems to us at Yes to Life and also to a lot of people we talk to that actually that's where change has to come from now, because it's clearly not coming from the powers that be. They're not doing it. They're not responding in an intelligent way to the situation. They're not actually, I mean, this is an obvious thing to do, you know, and other countries can see that, but not here. So we're kind of feeling like informing the public is the best thing we can do, and then public demand can start to drive change. And this opportunity to talk to you and tell all our listeners is great, of course. I hope more of them will be out there asking for PDT.
Yes, I think it's not the answer to everything, but it definitely has a place, in particularly in some very difficult situations. So some unfortunate people will get a mouth cancer and they'll get one after another, because if you think that the mouth's been exposed to the cigarette smoke and the alcohol intake, then popping one up after another, and you can cut the first one out, and maybe you can cut the second one out, but by the time you get to the fourth or fifth, it's getting a bit tricky.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much indeed.
No, it's my pleasure. That's good.
My next guest is Steve Wiseman, who's come to our office in Hoxton to tell me about PDT Norfolk, a charity promoting the use of PDT.
Hi, Steve, and thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Great. So photodynamic therapy, or PDT, has been around for a very long time, over 100 years, in fact, and it's taken huge strides in development in the last decade or so. It's a non-toxic treatment, very few side effects, which means it can be repeated as necessary without danger to the patient. It's considerably cheaper than conventional approaches, I understand, and it has a good evidence base, and it can be used with a wide variety of solid tumours. All in all, sounds like a massive win for both people with cancer and the NHS.
It does indeed. Yes.
Mm. So why do you think it's generally failed so far to even make it onto the radar of most oncology departments?
Well, we first came across PDT at the Yorkshire Laser Centre.
Yes.
Professor Kevin Magisi, who will be known among PDT specialists. And I think the reasons that it hasn't become known are really to do with clinicians tending to adopt what we would say a recipe book medicine. They kind of go for the kind of formats and solutions that they've been trained to follow, and they regard with skepticism anything that is different. And they will say, well, more research is needed before we decide that use of PDT is a viable option, with the exception of certain skin cancers. Yes. Of which they are aware. They're also aware that PDT is used for certain other conditions, such as macular degeneration of the eye. Mm. But I think it's a combination of lack of knowledge and a kind of professional pride that they feel that their solutions are the only solutions. So it's partly cultural and partly a knowledge issue. We actually converted a clinician who's retired, at Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, who had no understanding of PDT, and we kind of introduced him to the aforementioned Kevin McGeesey, and he then began to refer patients to Colin Hopper in London. So sometimes awareness is all that is necessary. And we're not saying that PDT is there for every possibility as a palliative or a cure or early detection, but it's an area that should be considered alongside other forms of treatment. Mm. Kevin McGeesey, I'll never forget, referred to the triangle of care, triangle of treatment regarding the use of chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, but why not have PDT as an option there, which in South Yorkshire it's commonly used because the local clinicians are going to refer.
Because the centre's there and
the knowledge is there, that's right.
Yes. I myself came across PDT more than 10 years ago when I was looking for solutions for my daughter, and I just found myself in the curious situation of explaining photodynamic therapy and how it worked to her oncologist in UCH, which is of course where the National Medical Laser Centre is. Amazing lack of awareness of the work that's been done.
We found ourselves in a similar position at the very onset of establishing PDT in Norfolk by meeting these clinicians and explaining how it worked. And some thought this is great, others thought this is something that isn't right. They were very sort of sceptical and said that, it's not proven, basically. Mm. So,
Yeah, so the UK's got a history of producing kind of international class medical developments, and the National Medical Laser Centre in London has been a major world centre for the development of PDT. But much as in the arena of cancer vaccines, I've just spoken recently to Professor Dalgleish, who's kind of the country's leading man on vaccines. The government support for these initiatives has kind of been pitiful, really, set against the dismal statistics for cancer generally, but particularly in the UK. It's nothing short of a dereliction of public duty, by the government. What do you think needs to change in order to address this problem?
Well, I think there should be some kind of compulsion on the part of clinicians to consider all options and discuss them with the patient. Now, some should be ruled out. Sometimes PDT is completely inappropriate, but that all these this should be discussed with the patient. And also patients need to be educated to be more aware of not just their rights, but the options open to them. I mean, sadly, patients just don't know what they don't know. Mm. And we've had a number of seminars in Norfolk where we've brought in various clinicians and campaigning organisations to kind of raise the patient's awareness and get them involved. And it doesn't always have to be people who are in a serious situation with cancer. It could be other kinds of illnesses, or indeed people are looking at preventatives to avoid cancer happening to them. And early detection is a big area for PDT anyway. In Scotland, we've been working with the University of Dundee, and they're doing a lot of stuff on early detection using photodynamic therapy. So there's lots of positive...
Another great field for it, of course.
That's right,
Yeah, well, so do you have any kind of estimate of, like, the proportion of cancers that where PDT could be applicable and thereby what the potential saving to the NHS is?
We know that there's a huge potential saving because the treatment is much cheaper to to carry out, and also it results in far fewer instances of the patient having to stay in hospital after the treatment, and much fewer side effects, in fact hardly any side effects, compared to chemo and radiotherapy. So that treating all that becomes costly. So we know that we haven't done a cost-benefit analysis. I think our charity is too small to do that, but I'm sure that kind of work could be carried out.
Well, it'd be a useful exercise, really, just to make the case, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, my guess is that the saving, if you're just going to look at it purely in financial terms, is astronomical. So it was huge.
Well, I think that's right. And I suppose comparisons could be made with what's going on in other countries. I know in China, yes, it's used routinely, for example.
So, yeah, that would be a good thing to do, probably.
But I think we have to accept that there are areas where a lot more research is needed on the various photosensitizers, for example, kind of getting the lasers into further other parts of the body.
Yes.
So there's a lot to be done, and that's why part of the work of PDT Norfolk has been to sponsor some research, and some of it's been lab research and also patient trials. Very early days yet, but we're hoping to do more in that area. And I hope that other similar types of organisation will mushroom across the UK in response to raising awareness, really, and what actually is needed. Get patients on board, really, and maybe some of the clinicians who feel that some changes should be made.
Well, many more patients are taking things into their own hands in terms of finding out their options.
Yeah.
They're coming to organisations such as ours, of course, we're, of course, very happy to tell people about PDT because it seems like an excellent option for many people. Okay, so, I mean, Macmillan's highlighted recently that many of the people who make up the rising statistic of the successfully treated have been, first of all, they've been through devastating treatment, but then they may be living with after effects that seriously degrade their quality of life. You've already mentioned the sort of lack of side effects. Can you say a little bit about the patient experience of going through PDT when compared to conventional treatments?
Well, from information that we have, chemotherapy, we know, produces all sorts of stuff because it damages the body in many ways, and there are lots of support groups around the country for patients, ex-patients who have suffered the long-term effects of chemo and also radiotherapy. PDT, because it concentrates specifically on the cancer cells, apart from an aversion to light for a short period, there are no known side effects.
Absolutely none.
That's another terrific reason for usage. And the argument is it's particularly valuable for people that are vulnerable, that can't stand surgery, for example, the frail elderly, but for anybody, really, because anyone it's an option. If chemo or PDT are of equal value in treating a particular kind of cancer, then one should always opt for PDT.
Well, of course. I mean, there'd be no patient who'd say, no, I'd rather have the one that's hell to go through and is likely to leave me damaged for life.
That's right.
Yeah. So.
And I think people are unaware of the long-term effects of chemo until it's happened, because aware of what's going on with patients, because there's a divide between non-patients and patients, non-cancer patients and people who have it.
That's true.
And people just don't have that kind of awareness, I think.
Yeah, and the experience we have here at Yes to Life is of being told, and it's my own experience as well, that the long-term side effects are not necessarily made clear to patients before the treatment either, particularly with radiotherapy.
Well, that's right. I think the other thing, it's repeated and it causes more damage. PDT can be repeated and it doesn't have
there's
any
no adverse effects.
There's no build up. This is it. This is the
no
issue.
No build up of toxicity, no build up of radiation.
That's right.
Yeah.
We all are in favour of the NHS, but sometimes because it's a statutory run service, it does preclude choice.
It certainly does. Yeah. And they've been banging on about patient choice for 40 years.
Yeah.
And it's only just beginning to emerge. I think the first shoots of patient choice are beginning to emerge now. But you're right, it's very prescriptive in that way. They look on a computer and tell you what you're going to get.
Well, that's right. And I think the whole thing of choice, it should be much more transparent, really. And, I mean, the consultant will say what's best for the patient and they in their view, the patient often isn't aware that they're just being given one option. They think it's the only option. They're not aware that this other possibility exists. There's obviously a tremendous respect for the clinician, and people are also distressed and fearful, so they will tend to go with whatever's recommended, not thinking that they have the right to a second opinion, and they can go to other hospitals. So there's no reason why they can't seek a second opinion from a clinician that does know about PDT, for example. So there's a huge amount of work to be done, and I'm glad Yes for Life is doing an enormous amount, obviously, and there's a lot more to be done, and more power to your elbow, I'd say.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think, I mean, clearly when the NHS arrived, it was like a massive step change, and just having medicine available, even if you were told what you were going to get, was like such a big step from before.
Yes.
It was fantastic at the time. It's simply that it hasn't moved with the time sufficiently, because, I mean, what was acceptable, you know, 50 years ago is just not to people anymore.
No.
People are far less prone to being told what to do with their own health. And so, yeah, it's
well, in 50 years, we'll probably look back on these times in the way we look back on the use of leeches nowadays.
I think we will.
Yeah.
Okay, so PDT Norfolk set up in 2012 specifically to address the lack of uptake in this important treatment.
Yeah, we're particularly concentrating on Norfolk, but clearly our research and our work has had much wider implications.
Yeah.
And so we'd like to see similar groups set up around the country, really. And it isn't just about PDT, as been the thread of this interview, really. It's to do about patients just not knowing enough about what's possible, really.
Right.
But PDT is certainly the area we major on, although we run a number of patient seminars on the broader field.
Oh, interesting. So just on patient awareness of their choices.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Okay. And so that is also, I didn't realise, yes, you're looking at PDT Norfolk as a starter for other centres like it around the country.
Well, I don't, whether it's in our control or not, I'm not sure, and that's up to the trustees, but hopefully we'll set an example to get other organisations moving forward. There are various groups around the country, maybe, that could be coordinated more, that do more awareness raising around particular types of cancer. And of course you've got your patient support groups, so a Macmillan possibly could be more proactive on PDT. Although they've got good information on their site,
They've got every reason to promote it, haven't they?
But they have.
Yes, it would seem as probably quite a good tie-up between some of the sort of cancer-specific patient groups and what you're doing. Because,
that's
of
right.
course, PDT has much more evidence with some than others.
Yeah.
And it's much more an obvious choice of treatment for some cancers than others. So that would be a useful tie-up.
And there's early precancerous lesions with certain kinds of lung diseases, which could later on become cancer. And I know Professor Sam Janes at UCL, that we worked with on an occasion, he was trying to get funding for a major patient trial, failed to get the funding, and whether he's now got it, I'm not sure. But he is convinced that this trial will lead to much better treatment of these early stage precancerous lesions, which will prevent a lot of people getting lung cancers.
Which is one of the big ones, of course.
And one of the huge killers, because it's no early symptoms. So
he should have no trouble at all getting funding for that, should he, really? Your professional advisor to the committee here, I mean, what made you roll up your sleeves? I think you're in a voluntary capacity here. What made you roll up your sleeves and want to be a part of all this?
Well, I kind of have a background of running a Citizens Advice Bureau, before that as an advice work, and I've always felt that this phrase, people don't know what they don't know, applies not just to patients but to people knowing their rights, and it's all about empowerment, and I just felt this carried forward, really.
And did you have some particular event that prompted
No, sadly, last year, well, not that long ago, but 6 months ago, my sister died of a very fast acting cancer, and she was victim of this situation of the appropriate clinicians were on holiday and didn't advise her of the right treatments. So that reinforces my belief that people just don't know enough. There wasn't a cancer event that got me involved with PDT in the first place, although a number of the trustees got involved because of people within their family victim of cancer. But mine was the idea that people just need to have more information at their fingertips to make appropriate decisions, I think.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I was talking to a couple of people about proton beam therapy and the clinic, you know, that Asher King went to. And the chap who'd been there, that he was singing the praises of the clinic on many fronts, but one of them in particular was that in his first appointment, they laid out all the options for his treatment and told him all the strengths and shortcomings of each one, including proton beam therapy, of course. And so he really felt empowered to make the decision that that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So that was before he committed to actually doing it. That's just on a preliminary visit. So, he was just said, like, if only we could get that kind of information in this country.
I think that's right. And I think the other side to this is people don't have the appropriate information made available. They could easily fall victim to somebody that's just trying to expensively sell a particular treatment that may not be appropriate. And that has happened in various parts of the world. And I think there's an article on the one of the NHS sites regarding a particular use of PDT, Sono PDT, that was ill-advisedly used. Now, I don't know whether that would have been effective, but there is a risk that people who are just trying to make a fast buck could be influential on patients that are desperate. And it's all the same side of the coin, really. People not being aware of things, either don't get told or at the last minute they'll jump to some possible solution that doesn't work. So yes. I think the key is making sure people are as informed as possible and can act on that advice. That's one side. And the other side is to gradually change the culture of the NHS clinicians, that they are more kind of enabling for patients and not directive. And some have that outlook, but it's a long way to go.
A long way to go, I agree, Okay, well, thanks very much for taking the time to come
on the
show.
No, it's been a pleasure.
I've been aware of PDT, as I said, for over a decade myself, and I've been continually frustrated by the way it's unavailable to those in need. So I wish PDT Norfolk every success.
No, that's good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My intention with this show was to raise public awareness of the enormous potential of PDT as an alternative to conventional approaches for a wide range of solid tumours. Despite the unthinkable amount of suffering the use of PDT could avoid, despite the massive cost savings it could bring to our crisis-hit NHS, it isn't going to make it into the mainstream anytime soon without a lot of public pressure. You'll find links to the NMLC, the National Medical Laser Centre, to PDT Norfolk, and all the other resources mentioned in the show on the Yes to Life website as usual. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, yestolife.org.uk, click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choose UK Health Radio. On next week's show, I shall be speaking to a medical herbalist with a background in genetics and medicinal chemistry who now specialises in supporting people with cancer, Chris Etheridge. Hope you can join me again. Goodbye.